coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this pre-recorded edition of The Curious Realm. I am Chris Jordan, your host. We are coming to you live from Austin, Texas here. I am currently on the road in San Diego, which is the reason for this pre-record. We've had a great holiday season full of awesome guests. Our guest in this first segment is the amazing Dennis Stone. His family has owned the property known as America's Stonehenge in New Hampshire for almost the last 50 years, at least. And it's an amazing property. I have been out there a few times and had the opportunity to go out and chat with Dennis about a year ago. And even some of the updates since then. Welcome to the show, Dennis Stone. Dennis, some of the updates since then are absolutely awesome. The fact that you guys are getting things 3D scanned right now to have interactive 3D tour, that kind of stuff, absolutely awesome. Amazing things that you guys are progressing with over there.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me on this evening. It's so nice to hear from you. And yeah, there's been a number of developments, I guess, that you were visiting us last, and we did that podcast, I think, from the Watch House, actually, yeah. When you were up. Yeah, that was really cool. It's kind of neat. A lot of things are kind of falling into place. And then we have like a dry spell where not too much happens for a while, you know. But in the last couple of years, we've had a lot going on, you know, and we've talked about some of it on your show before, you know. But we've done DNA testing on some bones last year. Oh. And they were found back in the 1930s, you know, and that we had almost 90 years between the time they were found and the time they were actually DNA'd, you know, and they turned out to be human bones, you know, and that was interesting. And then we had them carbon dated by the University of Arizona down in Tucson, and they were prepared by our carbon-14 laboratory, actually down in Tewksbury, Massachusetts. They used to be in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and my dad first used that laboratory back in 1967 for the first carbon dating. We've done 16 carbon datings on this site, and that laboratory did all but three, and those three were done by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute back in the 90s. So we've used them again just recently, but they could only prepare the samples. They weren't enough mass that he could do the conventional C14. So he had to send them down for a mass accelerator spectrometry. I guess it's 1/1000th a sample. And we've had that type of testing done by Woods Hole before, you know, and some back 30 years ago. So those bone samples are interesting. So that's one of the things that we did. We also use LIDAR, and the LIDAR of about 16 of the 106 acres, and we're about to do LIDAR of the entire property, which will be pretty cool. We have actually a local business, and the gentleman visited us about 5 weeks ago with his wife, I think, perhaps girlfriend, and they went up to the site, came back, and he introduced himself, and they're very, very excited. And he goes, you know, he told me where he's from, what he does, and the equipment that he has. And he asked if that would be of any interest, and I said, oh, certainly it would be. And I told him how we did the handheld LIDAR about 4 years ago, you know, with Tom Elmore from Connecticut, and how amazing that was. And his camera was a very, very high resolution, down to 1 centimeter. You could see 16 lasers, you know, a $50,000 unit with a high-definition camera on top. Awesome. And back about 4 or 5 years ago when he got that, the drone and airplane LIDARs did not have that resolution or that fidelity. You know, his fidelity, like 300,000 points per square meter. And back then, I think drone was 700 or 800 points, and aircraft were even less, you know, so you couldn't see things that clearly. But now the drone, I guess, is advanced, you know, the technology is advanced. So this particular piece of equipment, I think, runs close to around 90 grand, he said. So we're just waiting for him. We need the weather. He wants to do it before the snow falls, but with the leaves off the tree and on hopefully not too windy days. So in New England, you know, like, good luck to us on that, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm hoping he'll be coming in there to map. One thing I mentioned to this gentleman is we have found 30 of these windows over the last 8 years. These windows are holes in the walls we've talked about before.
Yeah.
They're located all over the entire hill. The other thing we found is 16 serpent walls, we believe, and those were found starting in 2016. And they're laying all over the hilltop of various lengths and shapes. And the other thing are slabs of stone that were being quarried. And the first one found in 1982 by one of our staff members having her lunch. Her name is Mary. And she was having her staff, her lunch on top of the hill, just sitting on a big slab of stone sticking out of the ground up near the North Stone. And she had already been told by our David Stewart Smith. David had been with us from 78 and he passed away in 2016. And David had spent several years working for the British government on both medieval and megalithic sites.
Oh, wow.
In the 70s before returning back to Connecticut and eventually moving around New England and becoming aware that these stone structures actually exist all over New England. He didn't know that when he left around 1972.
Mm.
So Dave had done a lot of work in the way the stones were quarried, the way the stones were shaped or dressed, and the way they were moved to build the site, the standing stones, you know, the sacrificial table, all the roof slabs, all these multi-ton slabs.
Yeah.
And they were actually shaped using a technique called percussion flaking. So they actually were striking the edge of the stone, shaping it. And he said, you know, look for stones that might have a serrated edge. Maybe they're out in the woods. Maybe they're kind of, you know, maybe they've been propped up a bit too, you know, by another stone underneath. And certainly she was sitting there looking around, looked down by her legs, and she saw the serrated edge. She saw the stone seemed to be elevated where she was sitting having lunch. And she looked under and could see, I guess, a propping stone. And she brought that to attention of David pretty quickly and the rest of the research, you know, people. And they looked at it and said, oh, wow, this might be one of the areas where they were actually, the ancient people were quarrying some of the stones to build the site or walls around the site. The following year, they excavated it. They found all the little flakes. They found some flakes of stone near the edge where it had been struck. And the fact the stone had been quarried off the bedrock, it had been raised up. Today we have 34 of them all over the hill up to 1,000 feet. So the idea is to maybe use this new equipment to actually map their locations. We don't know if there's a rhyme or reason, particularly for the windows, you know, scattered all over the hilltop. And the serpent walls in particular. I think the quarried stones, when the hilltop is pretty bare 4,000 years ago, and we have that from one of our archaeologists who actually mapped the hilltop using shovel test pits, STPs they call them. And she's now retired. She was a president of the New Hampshire Archaeological Society. And her picture's on the front of my new book, as a matter of fact. And she's a wonderful person. Again, she's in her 80s, so she's kind of retired from it. She can't do all the physical stuff, but she worked for us for 32 years, and she was out there mapping soil depth profile, and her husband was a doctor of geology at Tufts University for 30 years, so here's a big aid to her research of geological data, you know. But her idea is that the hilltop is really bare 4,000 years ago, so people were out there looking at the bedrock saying, I think this is a good spot to take a slab off. If you went out there today, as you know, Chris, you visited, there's forest out there, there's dirt, and there are some outcroppings of bedrock. But if I sent you out there to say, hey, I need a nice slab, you'd be like, what are you, nuts? I mean, if I had x-ray vision or ground penetration radar, maybe I could find a nice area, but I don't know. The area's covered with forest today. So we would have mapped those, you know.
Well,
I think it'll look incredible with that
And that's something to consider, Dennis, whenever you're on that property, whenever you're looking at that property, whenever you're just looking at the surrounding of the property, that is not major old growth forest that's there.
Right, right.
You know, that is forest that's been there for a couple few hundred years, something like that. It's not 4,000-year old forest, you know, so whenever this facility was built, and that's just it. That's what a lot of people don't understand, is it's not like we have an incredible number of megalithic sites here in North America, especially one the size of this complex, because this is acres large. It's big. While we did the interview, my family didn't even get to walk all of it, and that was an hour-long interview. hour and a half we sat there. Because a family came up while we were there, and you gave them the opening of the tour and then sent them on their way. Then we did the recording, if you remember.
Right.
And even in that hour and a half time, they hadn't had enough time to walk the entire property and see everything.
Right.
Like, I went with them because you were the one that let me in to the into the sacrificial altar, the quote sacrificial altar, as it's called. And they hadn't even been to that part yet. They were like, altar, what are you talking about? And that's when we went there. I have that up on screen right now. And it's fascinating when you get into this, when you start digging into it, because once again, the stones would have been much easier to find 4,000 years ago than they are now. Because once again, you don't have the 8-9 inches of dirt on top of them, things like that. Sometimes even more.
That's a good point, Chris. Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, about dirt up there, the dirt comes from windblown particles and vegetation decay. And they say in New England it's about an inch every 100 to 125 years, and there's erosion going on. So you will see some outcroppings of bedrocks that may have never recovered the soil since the time of the glaciers, when it ended around 12,000, 13,000, whatever the time period, the last glacial, the Younger Dryas and the Wisconsin Glacial Age, But the other thing, though, if you and I wanted to move some of those stones and log rollers, you certainly don't want them to be on dirt or going over roots and, because trees in the way and so forth. But if it's bedrock, it's a pretty hard surface. And there were some trees up there, I'm sure. Pat Hume said maybe 25% of the hill had vegetation and some trees and soil, but a lot barer than it is. And you're right on the money on that, Chris. Much easier back then than today. Unless you had heavy equipment, you wouldn't want to do it.
Well, even then, you wouldn't have wanted to do it. You would have been using the local trees, things like that, as rollers to move these. Either that or you were dragging it across the granite ground, because this rock that's here, this granite that's there, and specifically this very, very mica rich. I'll show a piece on camera real quick that I got, and you can see all of the sparkling inside of there. And it's fascinating when you get into specifically the alignments that are at this property and the finger stone, things like that, that are recessed inside of some of these structures, where it's almost like the light was meant to reflect off of this stone. When you start looking, especially at the way it looks, in the sunlight, I've got a picture of, it's got to be the winter solstice, which is coming up very soon. It's the picture with all the snow on the ground, which is why I assume it's the winter solstice and not the spring equinox.
Right, it is. Exactly. There's summer solstice.
I mean, technically in New Hampshire, they can both have snow on them.
Well, we could. Yeah, you never know New England weather. Just
But it's fascinating to see, because once again, the precision with which these are aligned, it's no random coincidence. It's not like, somebody put something approximately facing east. Once again, these are worked stones. The stone, whenever you go up and look at this stone, you can see where it's been flaked. You can see where it's been worked to the point that it's at. When you look at the alignments, I've got the picture on screen right now of at least the alignments from a few years ago, which I'm sure you have more as of now. I know I gave you a lunar alignment whenever I was there. I was like, hey, look, the moon rose over this just a few days ago. It's fascinating to see that. It's fascinating to see where this stuff comes from. It's fascinating to see where you there.
Hello, Chris.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to see where all of these alignments come from, Dennis, and what all of these alignments are that we have up on screen right now, because once again, I'm sure that you have additional alignments since you gave me this picture about 3-4 years ago. Because God, this one was given to me back in the Dudes and Beer days.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. That's right. That's been a while. Yeah.
It's been a long time. So numerous alignments have been found since then. You guys are working on stuff right now with alignments.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we started in 65 because of the book by Gerald Hawkins, Stonehenge Decoded. CBS Special came out because of that book and a lot of our members. So the first clearing of the winter solstice that you just showed was open in 65 into 66. The first pitch was taken in 67. And then after that, it really picked up in the 70s. And actually, we never cleared out the lunar major standstill, moonrise and moonset, north and south. And this is the time period right now during that 18 and a half year cycle.
Yep.
But we did do it with a forestry project starting in just going into the winter of 2019 into 20. Then they pulled all the equipment out. Then they came back and they did it the following year. So about 3.5 years ago, they finished a project and they opened up those alignments, those particular alignments for the first time. But they also opened up much wider, all the ones that had already been started, including the winter solstice, which we opened in 65 for the first time. So we're going to be watching this year. Right now, the moon's pretty far to the north as far as it goes. And it's more extreme than, you know, in a year or two from now, it's going to be going where it isn't as far north. You know, it's due to the moon's tilt to the Earth's orbit around the sun. It's 5 degrees, you know, so it is an important time, you know. In 9 years, we'll be watching it when it goes to the minimum, you know, north and south above the equator, if you will. So we're excited about it. And I started taking pictures a month ago because you can watch it right now, right into about a year from now. And then the moon starts to go to towards the next cycle, which will be in 2035 will be the next cycle, where it's very close to the equator. Right now it's very far from the equator. It sets further north and rises further north than the winter solstice, the summer solstice, rise or set. And then the summer is going to be further south than the winter solstice, sunrise and sunset, you know, because the moon moves kind of, you know, if you're watching the full moon, it's opposite the sun, actually. So right now it's very far to the sun's very far to the south. It's the opposite, of course. So as we come up on the full moon on the 15th, we're going to be photographing that. And I hope the weather works. We are in New England, so it could.
That's right.
And then again, it might not.
It might cooperate for 15 minutes and then go away.
Yeah, I'm going to do it on the 13th, 14th, and 15th just to make sure I get something in case we get some bad weather. But right now it looks okay. The sun looks like it's going to be sunny, and the moon should be out at night, you know. So I'll be watching that. And I will send you a couple pictures and put them on Facebook.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll do a
please.
Couple YouTube videos on that, you know. And but it'll be the first time ever. And we've been at this since 65, you know. So
and then, neat. And in that amount of time, once again, you have bones that have been tested. Any information from those bones yet?
Yeah, the weird thing was, it was done by up in Thunder Bay, Canada, by a guy who was involved with it who lives in Malibu, and he's on radio and stuff. He's done the Paracas skull. But so the results came back that they checked it with 39,500 different human samples, and it turns out it was of Greek ancestry from the Mediterranean area, of course. But at first it says the Mediterranean area, and then it narrows it down to, like, Greek ancestry. And then we had it, and that was in the spring of last year, over a year ago. It took 2 months. Actually, we found there were three bones. They were on display for years, and Goodwin, the first researcher, found them in the Plaza area back in around 1937. And fortunately, nobody threw them away. They were saved, which is wonderful. And he labeled them. He put used an ink pen on the back of them and identified them and everything with a code, like a little code on each one. And they felt they could be human back then. It's amazing. But in 1968, a woman from this area, she was a teacher from Timberland School. She drove them to Washington, D.C., to the Smithsonian. And a doctor, Lucine, I think her name was, St. Hoyan, a physical anthropologist, looked at him in 68. And she did not have DNA back then, of course, but she said, I think, and my best guess, after looking at them, examining them, looking at the hardness, the color of them, the density, she says, I believe these are human bones. I can't be 100% certain, she said, but I believe they were. And it turned out they were. She was right on the money.
Wow.
She, that's cool. And it turns out they are Greek ancestry.
Now, the Greek ancestry is very, very interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah, about a year ago, we got the results back on the date. And so they weren't prehistoric, but they could go back as early as 1690 AD. And they had like three different periods, with around 1850 being the medium date, 1850 AD. And that's a time period, and actually before that, quite a few decades before that, the Patty family were associated with the site, owning it and having a home up there. Patty family, actually, except for 28 years, were involved with this site, this hilltop and property, almost 300 years, starting in 1734. I'm sorry, 200 years, from 1734 when they bought the first piece of this hill, 10 years later buying another piece of the hill, and then for 28 years it went to a lumberman named Nathaniel H. Paul, then back to the Patty family, and then Mr. Goodwin bought it from a Patty relative named Fred Dustin in 1937. So over 200 years of being involved. But why was this person, whoever it was, because these bones were, two of the bones went up to Canada. We kept one in safekeeping with us in case they got lost in the mail. We sent them up separately through customs, and then we got the remains of them back. They have to use part of the bone in the testing.
Yeah.
So we got the remains back. And then we sent one of those bones to the University of Arizona, Tucson, actually to Massachusetts first. They prepared it, then they sent it down there. 4 months later, we got the results back about a year ago. And it turns out we got those dates I mentioned, anywhere from 1690 up to 1900, the medium date being 1850. So they don't have a real specific, you know, accurate date, you know, a very narrow date to give you a range with the most like, but why these bones were from the same person, they're different parts of the body laying on bedrock with a little bit of soil in front of the east-west chamber, because we have photographs of that going back to 1920. And even then it was just rock, bedrock and debris. Why would you leave a person rotting there on the ground, you know?
Yeah.
Who was this person?
Yeah.
So all it did is raise more curiosity. Well, it added to the mystery of, the hill is called Mystery Hill, so it added to the mystery of Mystery Hill. And we were kind of like, wow, why would anybody leave a person to, you know, just lie there and decompose? Well, the Patty family were there for decades and decades. And it's not like a dog might have brought those bones up from a local grave. They're pretty far away, over a mile away. It's the nearest graveyard. Why would the dog bring up three different parts of a body, you know? I mean, we just don't understand that, you know?
Yeah.
So, but we are using DNA. So we did that. We got into the DNA thing after all these years. And there's a whole history of those bones, you know, and going back 90 years to Smithsonian, and then, you know, having them actually done with DNA and carbon dating, which is, so we're still investigating, still using modern technology where it applies.
But even then, let's get into that, because of course there's a couple questions I can hear coming out of my audience's mouths right now. And the first one is, okay, so the people whose bones they were built the place, right? But you're talking about a family that's lived there, the Patty family. Now, when they arrived, it was there. They didn't build the structures that we see there, correct?
That is correct. Yeah.
I mean, they didn't. It's not like they built the large structures that we see or anything like that. It's not like, and granted, they may have built the stone walls that are there, but once again, who builds a stone wall in a serpentine fashion? Nobody marks property lines in that kind of way. Nobody makes a zigzag line when they're making a property line, you know, or a large S curve or anything like that. You know, those are normally laid out in parcel in very formatted acreage, things like that. So when you start looking at these structures, when you start looking at these things that are there, one of my favorite things is in the local histories. It's recorded the fact that when the original settlers of the area came, that they asked the local indigenous population, hey, why'd you build this? And they were like, oh, we didn't build that. That's been here.
There are those, exactly, Chris. It's a good time. We're planning on another book. You know, we did the souvenir book in 18, and then we 5 years to put the new book called America Stonehenge, the Stone Ruins of New Hampshire. That just came out last spring on the Equinox, actually. Mm. But the next one's going to be about, I don't want to give away everything, but it's going to be about the stone walls and just basically what you touched upon, because they've been a lot of talk about the stone walls, even going back to Mr. Goodwin back in the 1930s. The walls looked unusual because, as you mentioned, they turn or they twist or they bend, you know. farmer's wall is a fairly linear or straight, with some exceptions. And they used a lot of the field stones, kind of rounded kind of rocks for the most part, left behind by the glacial activity. The field stones are all over New England, you know. And one way to get rid of them is to build a wall. And that wall could be a stock fence. It could be a boundary. And a lot of them were boundaries. And some were actually just to clear the fields. But they served all three purposes in some cases. And when our surveyor started doing the survey work in 73 on the 16 acres of the 110 acres. He did a lot of, he went down to the county seat, and he also went into the town of Salem, and we were part of Haverhill, Massachusetts, until 1741, when New Hampshire and Massachusetts, New Hampshire wasn't incorporated until 1788, but we were still New Hampshire, I guess, and New Hampshire and Mass had a little boundary dispute on the southeast corner. Yep. We're located, and they finally moved the boundary further to the southeast, and we are no longer part of Mass. We became the Salem District, I guess, of New Hampshire in 1741. So he actually went into Haverhill, Mass, going back, before 1741 to see if any of these walls fit onto boundaries, our land, land boundaries and all of that, and they do not. And that report's there with, his name is Charlie Pearson of Beverly Pearson and Associates of Derry, New Hampshire, and he surveyed us starting in 73, and he worked right up to 77, and then that data was sent to the Harvard-Smithsonian for Center for Astrophysics about the alignments, and then in the 80s, he did more survey work. But one of his big things in a report that he did is that these walls, as you said, they do not, they don't look like farmer's walls. They turn, twist, and bend, and then we have serpent walls, but they don't seem to match old boundaries either, except for one down by next-door neighbor, the Dawsons. Other than that, of all the walls and thousands of feet of walls over the 106 acres, they don't fit boundaries.
Well,
I'm going to do a book on this.
Well, and
another book.
Not only that, Dennis, but I've got pictures up right now. I've got pictures up right now of the wall structure that has the marker stone in it that the sun rises over. And that's a good example of what you would typically find as far as a New England wall, where the slats of stone are stacked evenly on top of each other neatly to make what looks like a squared wall. Now, when you get into the serpentine walls, those are constructed differently. They are not neatly stacked on top of each other in an orderly fashion. It seems like they are much more piled together to make a ridge. A very defined ridge that goes along the top. And then in addition to that, in those walls are these windows. I've got a picture right now of one of the windows, and this is as close to it being, at least from what I saw when I was there, this is as close to it being an organized, typical stacked stone wall. Those are the only spots, or the spots with these windows, where it seems like they are there as observation points, something like that, something to like peep sight through, which once again, if you consider when the location was possibly built about 4,000 years ago, this would not have been a heavily wooded area. It would have been much more of a flat, rocky area. So to be able to see the horizon line through one of these windows would have been much more possible laying down on the ground to observe through
it,
or to observe the sun rising through it on something else as it came up over the horizon,
And that's one reason we want to map those with this gentleman's LIDAR, and get it very accurately measured and see if, again, the layout of each window, as well as how they relate to other windows, nearby. And map them, just get the whole, and what we'll do is have a map. In the book, I'll probably put the map with just the windows, and then we'll put the map with the serpent walls, and then we'll put the map with the slabs of stone, and then we can show the other walls, other walls too, that don't seem to be serpent walls, but some of those walls have windows in them too. They don't look, a lot of the correlation between windows and serpents, I don't know, but some of the walls have the, although some of the serpent walls have windows, and this is true of the Berkshires in Massachusetts, Jim Vieira, for instance, showed a friend of mine one of his serpent walls out where he lives, and he's been on History Channel and all that. I had his own show. He was a member of my dad's group, Nero, too. But anyway, he shows the serpent walls and there's windows in it. And you go down to Connecticut, you know, there's over 400 serpent walls. Some of those, I believe, have the windows in them. But some of our walls look like walls that aren't serpent but still have the windows, but they will contain monoliths. They will contain orthostats. Orthostats are big slabs just stood on the end, not vertically, but kind of on their end. And that's not what farmers were doing either. You know, they weren't pouring these big slabs that stayed on their end. So there's a different flavor and look to these walls as you're kind of, you know, talking about, you know?
Yeah. And once again, the assembly between the two is different and almost distinctly different. When you start looking, I've got the serpent wall up right now where once again, you can see that it's almost a loose conglomeration forming into a ridge. But down that wall, you have a part and you can see on the left where the loose conglomeration is. And then there's about three or four stones that make a window that are neatly piled on top of each other. And then a loose conglomeration of rock begins again. You know, so it's like these windows are very deliberately placed inside of what appears to just be a piling of rock to make this symbol. And it's pretty fascinating because that stone made of this specific sparkly stone that's in my hand that you were kind enough to let me take off property. Please, folks, whenever you visit places, don't just go snatch stuff. Dennis was very kind to let me, while I was there at the sacrificial altar area, grab this from underneath because it was a great example of that, this mica heavy stone that reflects light very, very well. And at the end of one of these serpent walls like this is a head. And that's where the finger stone is, inside of that small spot where the sun rises on it and actively lights that stone up. And it's interesting because when you start getting into the chambers that are built, Dennis, that's kind of something that I've mentioned for a while, is that they could very well just be observation spots where you're looking for very specific things rising in the sky, and the walls are great to be able to climb inside of and block out external light from a full moon or something like that while you're doing said observations, you know?
Right, yeah. I mean, we have the, I guess like one guy that did a book, a very good book, a classified astronomical alignments, like, I think he said like type one, I think it was, and it was, when you watch the sun, a moon, or a star on top of a stone setting or rising over that particular stone, and you have to have two points, a foresight and a backsight, two sides of either wood or stone or something to, you know, like a gun sight. Otherwise, you have nothing. But the other type is like where sun will go into a chamber, perhaps, like New Grange in Ireland, you know, or even the Newport Tower in Rhode Island, where it illuminates something. So it goes through like a window and it illuminates maybe a stone inside that's made out of like quartz or quartzite. Yeah. And that's what our watch house has, where the sunlight will go right into that chamber. The back wall has this beautiful, very light colored stone, which is quartzite, compared to the more gray, a little bit darker granite kind of stones all around it. And then it actually, we found out in 2020 after the forestry project began in the spring of 2020, had already opened up that avenue towards our neighbor's property, towards the south, I think it is, or southeast, and the sunlight actually came up. And a friend of mine from Texas, you know, she's on the road with Scott Walters a lot. She actually predicted with Sunseeker app, using that technology in 2019, she said in the spring when she first visited the site ever, she got into the chamber, turned around, held her phone up, and she goes, I think you're going to see the sun strike this stone inside the chamber on the equinox, spring or fall, around 9-ish in the morning as it rises, it should come in here and illuminate it. So we had to wait a year, and that's when the forestry project worked during that winter and opened that up. And 1 year later, I think she was back in Texas at that time, and I sent her the thing, but I said, hey, look at this. And we were there for the very first time, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, We saw that the sunlight had entered the chamber. The trees were no longer in the way. Even though the leaves were off the trees, you just could never see the sunlight go into the chamber until we cleared it. And there it was. It was actually illuminating the stone. It formed the shadow and light. On the top of the stone has a certain shape to it. And the shadow created by the entrance of the structure actually framed that top left corner perfectly. And then a half an hour later, we watched it and said, let's see what happens. It actually turned into a hand.
Yeah.
It looks like maybe
it looks like
a right
pointing.
Hand pointing at it, kind of, and it's a very, very quick thing at 8:30. But 2 years later, I was there, and we had seen, so there's three alignments for the equinox, spring and fall. You come up in the morning, you watch from the central platform, where all the other alignments are, and it rises over fallen, about an 8.5-foot monolith that's lying down today. Then you go down to the oracle chamber. There's another monolith near the entrance, and that is for summer, spring, and fall, and winter. We found that out recently, too. You watch that. It's pretty cool. And then I'll take you down to the – I'll take you down at 7:30 because I had never been there at 7:30 for that watch house illumination. So 2022, I'm down there yapping with one woman with my back to the chamber, looking at her. And I said, you know, we still got 30 minutes. It's 7:30. We got to wait here. Do you want to go down and get something at the building, you know, quick and come back up? Or and everybody else had left, you know, all the visitors. We had a nice turnout. They all left back to get coffee, go out to eat for breakfast and come back and watch the sunset later. Or maybe some went to work, too, you know. So as I'm yapping, I just turned my head into the chamber and said, yeah, we'll be seeing something at 8 o'clock. I think you'll be. And as I looked in there, the bottom of that quartzite stone, the very bottom right-hand corner opposite, you know, the 8 o'clock top left, the bottom of it was framed perfectly by the shadow and light. And then it's a one-hour illumination. And I was kind of shocked when I saw that. I got my camera out photographing it. And then I sent that to my friend from Texas again, Haley. And I was like, wow. You know, and Scott Walters saw it too because, you know, they do things together.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this is pretty cool. It's a one-hour illumination. And I think that's kind of like type two illumination, you know.
Well,
it's inside of a chamber, you know.
And just so everybody knows, like here, once again, here is the quartzite that he's talking about. You can see it's kind of a tannish color, you know. Comparing it, and I've got another piece that I pulled from the same spot. You can see there's not much huge difference lighting-wise, but you can see how the granite is much more of a gray, dull color than this. And seeing those two contrasted against each other, especially in the sunlight, is huge. It's fantastic. And to see it, especially in direct sunlight, is awesome. Now, getting into places on, we have you for about another 20 minutes. Let's start getting into the Oracle Chamber, because that's probably one of the most interesting spots on the property. It is right there with the sacrificial table, things like that. And it's basically called the Oracle Chamber because much like other oracles in the world where there was the altar and then a hole underneath where the priests were underneath the statue and the sound would come out, the Oracle Chamber is the same way. If you're looking on screen here, you can see I've got my mouse highlighting the sacrificial table. And if you see this wall that it's connected to with the dirt on top, that is the Oracle Chamber right there to the left. And underneath is a tiny little portal that you can see the underneath of the sacrificial table for. So, you know, if there was an initiation ceremony or anything like that, you know, that's where the voices would be coming out of. It's pretty fascinating, the construction of that, Dennis.
Right, yeah. It's about a 6-foot horizontal tube, if you will, through the wall from the Oracle Chamber, as you mentioned. And it runs east and west. And it comes out under the table, as you mentioned. And when Goodwin was there back in 36 visiting the site and totally taken by the site, and then he ended up purchasing from the Patty family, as I mentioned, 20 acres, that tube was not, you could not see that tube, nor could you just see the legs of the table. Everybody thought back then the table was sitting on dirt, just sitting there on the dirt
just
with
laying
nothing
there
under it but dirt. So, but it took to 1938, 2 years later in 38, to actually excavate around the table and clean it. We have the photographs of that. Fortunately, his right-hand man, Malcolm Pearson, was a photographer, and he photographed everything, which is great. When they dug down in 38, they found the legs, surprising, you know, supporting the table and the back of the table was supported by the Oracle Chamber wall. They also had the previous year inside the chamber had found a loose stone, and when a young man named Paul, one of the help there that was doing the restoration, he wiggled the stone, and he went back to the, they had a, by the back gate, they had a wooden structure. It was a bunkhouse, so people could stay there overnight that were working there. And they went to get a kitchen knife, brought it back to the Oracle Chamber, went inside. He put it in the wall to kind of wiggle the stone, and he was able to pull the stone out of there and found out it was like a plug. And when he looked, it was like a 6-foot tunnel, which they thought initially might be some sort of strange elongated closet, you know. And it wasn't until the next year that they were digging by the legs and down to the bedrock. The legs sit on bedrock. They had to go through about 3 feet of dirt. They found that there's a strange looking stone. It didn't overlap, you know, one over two over like bricks are laid, the way a lot of these stones are kind of put together, just kind of a squarish looking rectangular, whatever. And when they got there, the stone actually came out of the wall, and now we got the whole tube that comes out. Recently, we found on that side under the table, that part of the tube is actually flared like a clarinet or a trumpet, you know, or some sort of a French horn, the way it flares out. And we think that was for acoustical purposes, perhaps, you know, it's a thought, you know.
Well, in this space, I've got the video up on screen right now, the actual tour from your YouTube channel of you showing the tour of the Oracle Chamber. And it is a large space. It's not a small, I mean, I'm a 6-foot guy. It's kind of tight space for me head wise. However, lengthwise, size wise, like it's roomy. It's big. You could easily fit 3-4 people wide inside of the space. You know, it's a good 50 feet long, you know, so it's no small chamber that is lying inside of the Oracle Chamber.
It is a sophisticated structure.
Yeah.
It has 5 closets, if you will, or niches. It has 2 underground man-made drains that actually drain water out of it. One's towards the entrance, and the other one is a 45-foot underground drain lined with stones and capstones that run 45 feet. It's down at the other end of the towards the east as you exit the chamber today, which actually was a window, was not an exit as you see today. It was a small window there. The entrance had a very large lintel, and it's an east-west facing entrance. But the main axis that you're talking about where the speaking tube is north and south, and it runs, roughly 30 feet plus that entrance, you know, which is not included in that 30 feet. So you would have walked into it, walking east, taking a right-hand turn, and then you walked up that big axis.
Yeah.
About halfway up there is the other wing, which runs to the east. It's kind of Y-shaped, though, most if you took the roof off and looked down. So Goodwin and others called it the Y cabin. I don't think it looks like the Y cabin. It looks like a different letter. I'm trying to think right now offhand. But they call it the Y cabin for decades. But my dad changed the name of that later on to the Oracle Chamber because of the Oracle Tube. And I know my wife and I, we've been over to Greece. We honeymooned over there, went to Delphi, and we went to Rhodes later. But they had the Oracle at Delphi. We saw that. And then we went to Malta with my son in the 90s, late 90s, and we saw holes in the some of the constructions in Malta. And I asked the guy, I said, what are those holes for? He says, I believe these are Oracle Tubes where a priest, shaman, or a priestess or somebody would speak into this, and people would hear their voice thinking it was a god, goddess, or a spirit speaking, something like that, you know. And I said, gosh, it sounds like something we have back in New England, back in New Hampshire, you know. And the other unfortunate thing, those 2 plugs, I wish they had saved them. I don't know if somebody took them home for souvenirs. Well, they probably weighed, you know, 40 or 50 pounds each. I wish they had saved those 2 stone plugs.
Yeah.
And by the way, the 2 underground drains also had plugs in them. It's almost like they winterized the structure, and maybe they only activated it on solstices, equinoxes, you know, that kind of thing, or maybe cross quarter days, or a wedding or a death of somebody important, you know, where a priest would actually, because there's a bed in there too. I don't know if you saw that when you're in there, Chris, it's below the Oracle Tube, that big tunnel that goes underneath.
Yep.
And it's about 8 feet long from the very beginning to the very end. And there's a window in there. If you were lying in there, you could look out this window into the corridor that runs north and south. There's so many features of that chamber. You know, it even has 2 carvings in there.
It's fascinating.
You know, it's so much sophisticated. a lot of sophistication to the building of that. And it's corbelling in the roof on that east wing. It's all corbelled, you know?
Yeah.
It's not vertical stacking.
Well, and that's something important to bring up because, of course, in the video, I mean, people will probably be like, oh, there's wood beams up there. Yes, those wood beams were added for structural stability. They are not part of the original construction.
Those were put up there 40 years ago by Dr. David Stewart Smith again. He did that in the early 80s. And they're actually steel. And that is the reason that the lintel stone is missing at the entrance, because about 100 years ago, the town of Salem worried about that stone. The roof slab had cracked who knows when in the past.
Yeah.
It was a faulty roof slab. It split. It was coming down. They were afraid kids were going to get hurt or even adults. They lowered that lintel stone and they blocked that chamber up. They thought they sealed it for protection. This was around 1928. Yeah. But kids, knowing that where the window was a small little window, I think they started climbing in there causing damage to it. And that's the way you exit the chamber today. They did not childproof that chamber.
Yeah.
They tried to, but in the meantime, they damaged the lintel. They actually, ruined the entrance to that structure, which is sad, you know?
And, you know, with that in mind, especially with the fact that there was the family lived there, things like that. And of course, even the practice, which, many, many people were into in original archaeology that we now know you really shouldn't do. You know, like, hey, if you find a really cool coin, don't wipe all the patina off of it. You know, the patina is an important part of studying it. Finding something in its original space in the way that it was found, not reconstructing it along the way, is a very, very important part of the archaeology. How much of this location was either stones that were stacked by the family that lived there, or stones that were replaced by people as time went on, as things were discovered before instructions were given, like, stop rebuilding things, Dennis? You know?
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, we went out to the west and we saw a lot of the sites, recently too out there. We just did a tour of the mounds and they're not doing so much restoring and rebuilding. They do preventative maintenance today, on structures. So if something's falling down, they'll stabilize it. They try to fix it, so it won't fall down any further. And that's what we've been kind of doing over the last couple decades too. But Mr. Goodwin did restoration on the site. His idea was to take a rock within 3 feet of a wall that may have fallen off and place it back on top. But what we have is a photographic record going back to 1900. That's 37 years before Goodwin began his restoration work. We don't have photographs going back before the Patty family came there in 1734 or even diagrams,
Yeah.
But I think the Patty family, they did modify what became the cellar hole, and they put a wall in the middle. Today you put lolly columns, the metal pipes with the cement in them to hold your house up in the middle. If you have a cellar, that's, I know in Texas you have pads down there. I was surprised you don't have cellars down there. But we have them in New England, and what they did is they just built a wall, and that wall is it's a whole story about that too. It's a different construction. It's small stones compared to what we think was a courtyard built by the original builders with structures around it.
Yeah.
And they had the quarrymen up here. The Patty family actually had the quarrymen taking stones away for local projects. They got paid. Jonathan was not only a fifth-generation shoemaker, and there were other shoemakers later too, including his grandson, George, who had a shoe shop down the street. They were not stonemasons, per se. They were not stone builders or wall builders. They probably did some of that. But Jonathan also was a road surveyor for a couple of years. He was also a town tax collector. He knew the rules of the taxes. He did not quarry that stone at the site. It was done by the ancients, and he sold it. There was a quarry tax. So if he had quarried that himself, or his one son that lived, or his nine daughters, or whatever, quarried that stone, they would have had to pay a tax on it. So he saved a little bit of money. They caused damage to the site. They estimate 30% of the site was taken away.
Oh.
And so we have photographs of 1900. I had somebody, a critic, say, well, the site's been messed up. If you look at Stonehenge, if you look at Newgrange, if you look at Mesa Verde or Chaco Canyon, we've been to all of these sites, and you look at photographs from 100 years ago, some of these sites aren't even recognizable because of the restoration work, and particularly Newgrange. We've been there in Ireland. It doesn't even look recognizable, except for the window box. You can't even recognize it. We did a whole lecture about that. Our site gets criticized, but I said to a friend in England, I said, what site in the world hasn't been messed with? Because that was a critic saying, it's been messed with. And we do have photographs of the site before the restoration, which is good.
Which is hugely important. That's hugely important.
Yeah, and our site is not guilty of anything by that any more than Stonehenge is. And I have pictures of Stonehenge with cranes. I don't know if you've seen those. And when They have the daylight savings time. It comes up on Facebook as kind of a joke. Look at them moving Stonehenge, so it still is correct, you know, for the time, yeah. You know, or the time change, you know. That was done at Stonehenge too, you know.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, that's just it with this site, Dennis. I think that's a big part of the consternation. I think that's a big part of the reason why you're having a problem finding a replacement for that former state archaeologist that used to work with you, who is now retired. This does change a lot of things. When you start looking at the construction of this location, when you start, it pushes dates back, man. When you're talking about local indigenous population saying, we found this when we got here. It's not like the local indigenous built large townships or anything like that. They lived in wickiups and stuff like that, and you know, traveled most of the time wherever the crop was that they were harvesting or wherever the food was that they were hunting. You know, they didn't have major huge settlements or anything like that in the localized area.
Generally would. Yeah, we just went to the Plymouth Patuxent, you know, for Thanksgiving, right, at Plymouth Plantation. They have the Native American village there, too, and they talk a lot about that, too. And they're made out of wood, and because their longhouse is, that was the Pilgrims, but the Native Americans had, it was called a wiki, I think. It's a wigwam is the word that we use today.
Yeah, wigwam.
But they also had the longhouses, and they would last, I was surprised. Some of them could last 15 years. And we built a couple of wigwams at our site because we have found the 30-foot diameter wigwam remains. Pat Hume, as you mentioned, our archaeologist, she found that over 30 years ago and had three carbon datings, 2,000-year-old, 1,700 years old, and 1,200 years old. But those wigwams, they said they might last 15 or 17 years with proper maintenance, and then they might burn it down. They might even move to a new area because they may have over hunted the area perhaps, or if they're growing crops, they might want to move to a new area. I know they use fish for fertilization, but they described moving to a little bit different area perhaps, and they would burn their old village down, and they didn't want the sense of the human sense there, because animals would stay away from there, you know, and stay away from that area. So they wanted that maybe to be hunting ground, so they would just burn it down. It was all rotting anyway, and they would build a new village.
Well, but it wasn't building it out of stone.
You know? It's a whole stone thing, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't built like this. It wasn't built like cobbled together caves, things like that. That's not what they lived in. That's not what they used. And I've even posited the fact, aside from using them as observation points like we talked about, I've even posited the fact of perhaps they were used as meat locker, you know? While they were there on hunt or something like that, you know, the idea that we can easily put our kill for the day inside of here and then put a brick over it and then go over there 2-3 miles down the road overnight, you know, and then hunt in the morning and no bear is going to come pull the big heavy stone off of the cave that we built that's protecting our food.
Right.
You know, things like
there's
that.
There's a thought of that going back to, it's a legend. I don't know how accurate it is, although there's been some study by a couple of our investigators, Andy Rathovius, one of the early NARA members, but that Passacarnaway, a very, very Native American chief who either lived to be 102 or 120 years old, a very peaceful, very, very wise Native American chief, or, you know, I guess he was a great, you know, very wise, very big, very, very, popular, or people loved him, you know?
Yeah.
And like a statesman, but they say he may have kept some of his furs in our chambers, so he may have repurposed an ancient ceremonial site.
Sure.
And, you know, much, much later, in the 1600s, and I would too, you know, if I saw them up there, and I knew, like you said, we could protect maybe some, you know, for meat or for furs from wild animals and predators, maybe bring them in there. And he was trading that with the English too, I believe.
Yep.
That would make sense. We just have to find the evidence, but that's one of the traditions I think people talk about, you know?
When you look at the quote sacrificial table, which I have on screen right now, like as somebody who grew up hunting, like that's a dressing table. That to me is the perfect spot to be able to slaughter a deer for all the blood to fall into the groove and be able to be pushed and collected, all kinds of stuff. And hey, right there next to it is a spot where you can either is the small little cavern where you can either store the meat or build a fire outside of it. You could even smoke it right there.
That's one of the thoughts, you know?
Processing plant for a native culture right there. And that's just a hypothesis. But the question is, do you find any animal bones in that kind of mass like you would whenever you're hunting in that kind of way? Do you find any kind of fire remnants inside of the caves where maybe somebody was smoking meat or that kind of stuff? No.
There is a, you don't find the heating, and that does leave a telltale sign on the rocks. It usually brings out the eye and the reddening of, and the heat cracking, the thermal shock.
Yep.
There is a chimney flue in that chamber, but we never saw, first off, when Goodwin got in, they didn't find any charcoal and all of that stuff. It could have been, washed away over years, but never found the marks in the rock itself where the fire would have been to show a great, so it might have been used for ceremonial purposes, almost like when they have a new pope, they send smoke signals up in the Vatican.
Yeah.
And had two stone louvers and had a capstone that actually sealed it off. And Goodwin didn't even know this beautiful chimney with two stone louvers and the rock on top even existed. And they built a fire there to see if they could heat it up, not knowing that that chimney flue was there. And they smoked themselves out of that thing in about 10 minutes. They said they were coughing. Now, after that, they discovered that the ceiling had an odd shape to it, and they got above it, and they removed some soil, and they found a stone. They moved the stone aside. It was like a sliding stone, and they saw the two louvers, and now we have a chimney. And they tried it then, and they heated it up in 15 minutes, and they didn't have a smoke problem because it drafted through that hole in the ceiling with the two stone louvers, but the site, I think, was an ancient ceremonial site, but all those points you made, I think people later could have repurposed it for other purposes, including a table, I think. It looks too ceremonial to me.
Same.
And we're finding, by the way, with a LIDAR, that the floor plans of these chambers, the sacrificial table groove, and there's a little alcove next to the table where an animal could be kept before sacrifice, if you will, has two little niches. They're all trapezoid in shape, and the LIDAR shows that. You can actually go up with a tape measure and do that. 90 years ago, Roscoe Whitney, the chief foreman on the project, said, "I'm not seeing 90-degree corners to these structures." That's one of his things. He also says, "I don't know what unit of measure they used to build this, because I've looked at the height, width, and depth of these structures, and they didn't either know linear measurements or give a damn, because I'm not finding imperial measurements of the inch, foot, yard, or
Nothing
like
in the megalithic yard. Nothing in the realm of a cubit or anything like that.
No, the megalithic yard seems, I detected that when I built my diorama in the 70s. We went up there, already aware of Dr. Tom's work, and it seems like that might be it. And recently with the LIDAR with Tom, Elmore and his LIDAR, looking at all of this on the screen, because you can see down to a centimeter. And also using a tape measure with my son, who's an engineer at Raytheon, we went up there very carefully. And Pete, our assistant archaeologist, he's actually a stonemason with the Boulder First Degree. He's been doing that for almost 40 years. He measures stuff every day. So we went up there and started measuring some of this in the megalithic yard, not only at our site, but some of the other sites in New York and the Hudson Valley that's doing work down there. It's preliminary, though. We need to do more work with that to see if there's anything to it,
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe the megalithic.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, no. So that's one of the things we'll be doing with the LIDAR, too. We have a 1 terabyte hard drive, and we finally, Tom gave us it 2 years ago, and we're actually got the software now that we can actually open it up and start to play around with it and start looking at these measurements and these structures. And it also shows the core building in the corners of these structures. It also shows a trapezoid shape, as I just mentioned. So farmers weren't building like trapezoidal shaped structures, They're mostly rectangular, square, and their corners are usually 90 degrees and vertical. These corners and these chambers actually tilt in the core building effect, So this is a little not typical of what our farmers or early settlers were doing here. And that standard unit of measure is another piece of evidence, I think, very strongly. Well, by the way, we did do OSL dating, optically stimulated luminescence dating, by the University of Washington. And one of the One of the samples was taken from the end of a serpent wall. We were talking about the walls, and just, you know, we have opinions that these might be ancient because of the serpent shape, turn, twist, bend, big slabs of stone, that kind of thing in the windows. However, this is actually a piece of evidence that that wall was sitting there, and the date, it took 2 years to get the results back. It was in 2022 that the tail of that 2,550-foot serpent wall, if that's what it is, right by the watch house where that illumination is, the dirt saw the light of day last in 1400 AD.
Wow.
So, yeah, see, so that's not just somebody's opinion. Go, well, I think it's old. I think it's new. I think it's whatever, you know.
Yeah.
That's one of the dates. The Oracle Chamber roof sample showed it was up to 2 feet deep on top of that roof, the dirt. It could have been shoveled. It could have been accumulation over eons. But where they got the sample from, it was right on the roof, and it came back at 1550 AD. That structure was over. Dr. Feather says, well, the dirt shows it saw the light of day 1550. That's pre-colonial in our area.
Yeah.
And the chamber precedes that. The chamber has to be there before that, either years, hundreds of years, or a day before that. That structure is sitting there, and then that 1550, that's not the Patty family, you know. And everybody, all the Pattys built everything up there. They're, you know, they had not six Husky sons. They actually had one son. One son died in Boston 3 days shy of his 18th birthday, and he had nine daughters. We have all the names. It could have been Husky daughters, but I don't know. You know, family up there just building the whole site is what some people have contended over there.
A determined aunt will carry the sugar cube himself. Dennis, they don't need help. However, the real question comes to bear if it was there when they got there, and quite obviously it was. Because once again, whenever the original settlers, not even that family, whenever the original settlers of the area asked the locals, the indigenous population, they were like, I don't know, we didn't build that. That's been here since we got here.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's a site in Connecticut, Gungeewomp, right near the Navy base. And Gungeewomp's been known, it's fairly well known too, you know, in the Northeast and by others that are interested in this whole thing. It's been on TV, History Channel. And anyway, in 1654, 370 years ago, a guy named John Pynchon wrote to Governor Winthrop II asking, we believe he's talking about these stone ruins that cover today about 250 acres. It's more spread out than our site. It doesn't have some of the complexity, but it is an amazing site nevertheless. It does have a lot of features there, and chambers and everything. But they were talking about that 370 years ago. So if our early forefathers and, you know, whatever families were building these things, why are they asking 370 years ago what the heck this place was, you know?
Yeah.
We don't see the reply, unfortunately. It would be kind of cool to get the reply of that letter, you know? But
yeah.
John Pynchon writing to Governor Winthrop, you know, the second. So people have been raising that question for years, you know?
Exactly, exactly. And the question goes on, and the exploration goes on, and the excavation goes on. It's fantastic.
Absolutely.
And not only that, but the alignments go on. We're getting ready for a major alignment coming up. Before we let you go, Dennis, because our time always just flies by, dude, seriously.
Yeah.
I looked at the clock a few minutes ago. It's like, holy crap, we're already at 50 minutes. But where can people go to find out more about America Stonehenge? Where can they go? Because, of course, you're going to be having the 3D tour up here fairly soon, hopefully, you know, within a few months, things like that. But where can they go to find out more information? Where can they go to get involved? Where can they go to come visit and to follow America's Stonehenge? Let everybody know all the good details.
Well, it shows like yours that really help out spread the word that our site, plus there's about 800 of these sites from Quebec down to Virginia. Although I was just kind of the highest density in a given area, like the Reader's Digest, as you were kind of alluding to the complexity on 106 acres.
Yeah.
So we have a website at StonehengeUSA.com, and there's links in there to other sites and other organizations. Our website has our 11-minute theater view. Introductory video that we play in our theater. It also has a free app download, and you can do a complete virtual tour from your couch or lazy boy at home, and it takes you up through all the different structures, just like our tour guide map does, and it has a picture, text, and it talks to you about the structure, so you can do a virtual tour at home.
Cool.
There's also, let's see, we do very frequently we're doing YouTube videos. They're like 3 or 4 minute videos. I think we have 180 of them out now.
Nice.
Our manager James is in charge of that. He does about one weekly, if not more. And I'm on quite a few of them. James is on many of them, and we're going to continue doing that. Also, that goes on we do the Facebook, we do the TikTok. So those are some of the areas. But I go to a website, you know, StonehengeUSA.com, and from there you can find a lot of different information. Our phone number's there, email address is there, and we will get back to you if you have any questions, you know, definitely. And then we're on different shows like yours. You know, we get on quite a few radio shows and TV shows, and which is kind of nice also, you know. So
yeah.
Helping to tell about these sites, you know. It's like an ancient lithic culture stone builders, David Stewart Smith told me before he passed away in 2016. The stone building, this lithic culture is across the Northeast and actually beyond, because we're finding the Serpent Walls all the way out to California. Yep. And in between Winnipeg and Denver, near Denver, east of Denver, down in Alabama. But he said it's an ancient culture that has not been recognized. It's been ignored by mainstream archaeologists, in some cases actually ridiculed by mainstream, saying that these structures are nothing more than some crazy farmers. And if, you know, basically telling developers, people that are putting roads in, maybe even towns or states, these things aren't worth anything.
Yeah,
and
don't worry about
their
it.
Legacy in the future for the destruction of these chambers. I hate to say that's going to be their legacy, but it's slowly changing, I think. You know, and we're trying to get the word out to educate people to try to take care of these things, to recognize them for what they are. We think
that's
it's
right.
part of our ancient past. You know,
I firmly believe the same, Dennis. And thank you so much for everything that you are doing to preserve the history there. Thank you so much for everything that you guys are doing to further the excavations there. I once again love having you on a few times a year to hear updates on this location, because it's right there in people's backyards. Right there in people's backyards.
Thank you so much, Chris. You know, we love being on your show. We appreciate it. And I want to thank your audience too. And, you know, if I have anything that comes up, any really cool news, I'll send you something off quick. But I'm going to be in communication with you when we get more of this work done with the LIDAR and everything anyway.
You bet.
So.
You bet.
But thank you so much again.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick while we close things out for the segment. Always an amazing time talking with Dennis Stone. Stop on by americastonehenge.com is the website that we have up right now. Amazing stuff. Their mobile app is really cool. Once again, stop on by, check them out. Make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com. That is where you can find our videos page at curiousrealm.com/videos. And we have all of the YouTube channels of our guests, including America's Stonehenge, everything else embedded right there for your ease of finding. You don't have to go searching anything like that. Just go right where you're familiar, curiousrealm.com, and go to videos, and you will find all of our guest stuff embedded right there. When we come back from this commercial break, folks, we will be joined by Chester Moore of Higher Calling Wildlife. He hosts the show Dark Outdoors, and in that has come across some information regarding the Rainy Street murders here in Austin, a string of possible serial killings that has happened, 13 bodies that have washed up on shore of Lady Bird Lake here in town, and the fact that they may be connected to a string of killings across the north end of America called the Smiley Face Killings. So we'll be talking about the Smiley Face Killings and their possible connection to the Rainy Street murders with our good friend Chester Moore right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that short commercial break. Thank you so much for staying tuned through that. And also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. They are your source and my source for amazing CBD products. If you have been told by your doctor, like I was, you know, that CBD may help with your anxiety, things like that, stop on by, check them out. They have amazing products. I've been using them for a good 5 years, 6 years now, and Christopher Lynch makes some amazing stuff. Full spigeric process. Every part of the plant is used, then reused, then combusted and reused, and every part of it ends up being turned into an amazing full-spectrum CBD product with terpene profiles, all kinds of stuff. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to get your official discount of 7% or more in your cart and get two, count them, two edibles on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Chester Moore. Welcome back to the show, Chester. Man, you have been more than busy. You've been out on the road doing bighorn sheep release stuff, things like that for Higher Calling and for Texas Parks. Well, I guess not Texas Parks and Wildlife, but what?
Well, I was out. You know, I do a lot of contract work in the wildlife world.
Yeah.
So I was blessed to be able to go out on behalf of the Wild Sheep Foundation and cover this amazing restoration of desert bighorn sheep and putting them in the Franklin Mountains for the first time in over 100 years. Yeah, that's the shot I took of old number 14 as he came out of the trailer, busting out the trailer. And
wow.
So it was an incredible example of science-based wildlife conservation, and it was awesome to be able to be there and doing some work with an organization I respect, and doing some photography, which is always fun, and covering this story. And there'll be more coming later on. So it's always an honor and privilege to get to work with people with a vision like that. And of course, Texas Parks and Wildlife, that's their state park. They oversee that, and they are managing this population. And groups like the Wild Sheep Foundation and the Texas Bighorn Society contributed to it greatly financially and other ways. So, that was a lot of fun. But let me tell you something, bro. I decided, you know, I'm headed back from El Paso. I live in Orange, literally I'm on the New Mexico border. Then I drive to the Louisiana border where I live. And, I think I might have hallucinated through about 5 hours, just punch drunk from the drive. I'm completely clean and sobered. I think I was seeing visions and stuff. I'm pretty sure there's a 5 hour chunk I don't remember driving.
Wow. You
know, it was like 16 hour straight shot back to Orange.
It's a zone of a drive. That's for certain.
Yeah, baby. You got to really want to do that one. But it was great. And it was a great way to sort of cap off my travels for the year. And because there's a lot of other things going on in the dark outdoors realm. And with other projects happening.
Well, and that's why we're having you on. I mean, Dark Outdoors is, of course, an award-winning podcast from the Texas Press Club, all kinds of stuff. And you do, because of your work in the world of, you know, wildlife preservation, things like that, you are out in the outdoors regularly. You're out in state parks, regional parks, city parks, all kinds of stuff, doing these wildlife releases, doing work with kids, doing work with families, all kinds of things. And unfortunately, it has unzipped for you a very seedy and seamy underbelly to these places that are nestled right up against suburbia, you know, and especially when you're talking here in Austin, you know, there is a great move to the outdoors. There's tons of people out on the park trails, things like that every day. Lady Bird Lake is a huge area for it. And, over the last many years, I've got the Rainy Street serial killer rumors up on screen right now from the San Antonio News and from mysanantonio.com. And as of 5 months ago, they found the 13th body, 13 that have been found, able-bodied young men, you know. Most of these are college age, early to mid-20s. Stuff like that, being found washed ashore, floating in the water. And it's fascinating.
This is another one, December the 2nd. another body found.
Wow. Wow.
Found by a kayaker. That one's just come across my radar because I missed it a little bit.
I can't believe I missed it while I was researching this. Literally.
Dude, I mean, it's like they're popping up like crazy. So on Dark Outdoors, I have had the privilege of having a great investigator named William Ramsey on. He has written a book and he's done a couple of documentaries about the smiley face killer phenomenon.
Yeah.
And what that is, it's basically younger men, usually, but not always, between about 18 and 30.
Yep.
That go missing. They find their bodies in water. And then when they're gone for a month and then the coroner says they've been in the water 48 hours. So it's like they're being held and then put in water for the perfect crime. And it's targeting specifically men. And it's a bizarre rabbit hole of a story, but it tends to be the areas sort of get targeted. Like it started in New York because there were some police officers who noticed that there was a couple of young men who went missing in different times. And, you know, the stories didn't line up and they wrote a book about these friends. I think it's called Forensic Case Studies and Drownings or something like that. I have to look it up, but they went with these different experts and saying, hey man, the official diagnosis here doesn't add up, you know? And so if you go back and listen, go Dark Outdoors, available on all podcasting platforms, whether you're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio or whatever, you can go back and listen. I have three different smiley face killers episodes. And the last one is specifically targeted on the Rainy Street Lady Bird Lake situation. Now, Chris, you've been in the Austin area for a few days.
A little bit.
Yeah. So the question I have is, there have always been bodies that'll pop up in a city lake.
Sure.
But not even remotely in a frequency like this.
No.
Not even remotely in a demographic like this.
No.
And that's the thing that people... What's happened on the, a lot of bad things have happened via the internet, but a good thing that's happened via the internet is that people can see through political BS and they're able to kind of connect the dots themselves and go, whoa, wait a second here. You're trying to tell me all these people are getting drunk and falling in the river?
Yeah. Yeah. And like I'm from Houston, grew up going to Lake Houston all the time to fish, things like that. Yep. I grew up in West Houston, going to not only Attucks Dam and Reservoir to go fishing and hiking, but also just roaming around Buffalo Bayou. And there were tons of people that jogged the bayou, hiked the bayou. And yeah, you know, you definitely ran across homeless encampments, things like that. But you didn't hear about a great deal of like body washed up in Buffalo Bayou. You know, things like that. There were not a whole lot of reports. There were some reports about, you know, maybe a missing body during floods, something like that, which happened pretty regularly. Hurricanes, that kind of stuff. Even boating accidents along the San Jacinto River and Banana Bend were pretty regular. Whenever I was growing up, that kind of stuff. But you didn't hear about just like healthy, able-bodied young men washing ashore.
No, and it's this crazy pattern. And, you know, William Ramsey really goes into this, different cities that have had these kind of like, we call them like a UFO flap, you know, like, you know, you have these sort of flaps, you have these trends of this going on.
Yep.
And I honestly thought once the media really got into this smiley face thing on Lady Bird Lake that it would stop. I thought it would stop, but it has not stopped. It has continued, which kind of ties into something else that I've done on this whole thing. So if you look back, one of my first Dark Outdoors episodes was about these mysterious horse killings.
Yep.
That were happening. And this one, there's different sort of subsets of these killings, but one of them was in a neighborhood area and the meat was being harvested. Now, if I'm a thug criminal, and I'm wanting to like sell illegal horse meat, you could go buy some at the auction really cheap. You could go. There's tons of people who have horses on ranch land where nobody's ever going to see you kill them. Why do it in a neighborhood on five different locations?
Yeah.
I think part of the thrill was doing it in someone's backyard. Someone was wanting to eat someone's personal pet.
In proximity.
Yeah. So I think this is the same thing. I think maybe with whoever these people are, because I do not believe it's a killer. I think that there is a newfound thrill of doing it right in front of everyone's face and taking the fear level for the community. I think that's part of it. You know, William Ramsey believes the smiley face killer phenomenon is not a group of serial killers necessarily. He thinks it is a MO, a method of operation traded in the dark web that these other groups can pick up and do. So it's not necessarily like smiley face killers hangs out in Austin for a year. Smiley face killers move to Boston for a year.
Yeah.
They move to St. Paul for a year. No, that there is a MO traded in the dark web, in the dark underground of how to do this, and maybe trading notes, you know, that kind of stuff. So, and I think that's definitely
kind of
part
kind
of the
idea of a living snuff film, and the actual film is the trail of newspaper articles.
And exactly. And there could be snuff film attached to a lot of this stuff going on as well. But it's frightening because women, look, I know we live in a world where we're supposed to act like, you know, the average woman can take out Brock Lesnar or some UFC champ. But generally speaking, females are not as physically strong as males.
Well,
and that's just reality biology.
And granted, that's why. The body found on the second was a female. Most of the bodies in the series of smiley face killings since 1997 have been men.
I think so. This is what I'm kind of getting to here. Generally, think women are like cognizant that there are aggressive, evil men out there,
sure,
who are wanting to use their strength to overwhelm them, rape, hurt, kill, whatever. So women will go to the bathroom with each other. Women will travel when they get into drinking with each other. Men will be lone wolfing it, right?
Yeah.
And then we have a woman found. And there have been a few women found in weird situations like this. Is it possible that they're switching their MO to, you know, mess with people or strike fear in a new target? Or has there been a new breed of this coming on?
Yeah.
You know, and so the idea of people targeting a lot of them are athletic young men who are very strong in the prime of their life.
Yeah.
Shows like completely different than someone wanting to take out a 21-year-old, 85-pound woman.
Well, and that's just it. You know, whenever you're talking about most of these guys have been inebriated. Pretty well inebriated, stuff like that. Yep. But even then, slip, fall in the water doesn't mean you forget how to swim, even if you're inebriated.
I mean, there was one canal, one of the cases back, you know, one of the early ones in the mid-2000s were like, you know, they drown in like a 4-foot canal.
Yeah.
Supposedly. Like the guy's 6 foot tall. Yeah. He could stand up, you know. And one of the things is they find a high level of GHB, the date rape drug, which is apparently a hormone we have in a lot of these cases. And so there's definitely some going on. And I believe that every one of these, in my opinion, involves more than one person.
Well, and there were many cases where bodies weren't just like washed ashore. They were found like tied down, moored down, things like that.
Yeah, it's really weird, you know, but and you got to realize there's people, these killers may be developing this to where individual ones are putting their signature on smiley face methodology.
Yeah.
And the reason they call it, let's go back a second. The reason they call it smiley face killers is because many of the early cases involve a smiley face being painted around the area where the body was dumped, a fresh smiley face painted, and ended up being that one of the victims a month after, and this is before smiley face killers became like a phenomenon, had a smiley face painted on their tombstone. And so that's the reason it's called smiley face. People get this mixed up with the happy face killer guy.
Yeah.
You know, but this is a different holder. I just wanted to back up and say that. But I think this is definitely ongoing. And here's the other thing that I really think. I know for a fact there's at least one case in Houston that is so similar, ended up in the Houston Ship Channel someone. Yep. And I think that this is happening in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And you're going to see this outpour all over once people start locally connecting the dots.
I remember when this first hit, it was when I first started listening to Coast to Coast. It was one of the first things that I remember from Coast to Coast was hearing the two detectives from New York.
Yeah, it's like Danim and I forget the other guy's name.
That started the research and found cases in the Midwest. It was right at the same time that like left feet started washing ashore in British Columbia and things like that. There it was this weird confluence of cases across America and the Northwest like this. And the smiley faces kept popping up everywhere. Yeah. And it was all over the place. And this birthed the hypothesis by the FBI. That many serial killings like this, and they started calling them serial killings because the MO matched up, that kind of stuff. They could never prove any attachment that it was the same person, anything like that. But there seemed to be a lot of match in the MO. There seemed to be smiley faces along the trail, that kind of stuff. And it birthed this hypothesis that perhaps it was somebody like a trucker, somebody who did like east to west trucking. You know, something and, like and, that. And somebody who is out. Transient.
There's a new book out that's all about trucking serial killers.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it's all about that. And you mentioned, Chris, the interstate commerce and ways of doing this. If somebody's regularly making deliveries from Detroit to Austin.
Hey, you could be a traveling technician like me that's on the road 40 weeks a year.
Pop in, pop out.
Popping into a city for 3 days, leaving.
William Ramsey mentioned one of the cases where there was a live band in a bar, and he mentioned, what about traveling musicians? You know, that's another thing. And I want to say this as a cautionary thing to anyone in the Austin area if you go out partying and drinking.
Yeah, man.
Okay?
Yeah.
Let me say something very important. I have no doubt in my mind that at some level in this case scenario, there's a bartender or someone working in the clubs that is tied into this. And so be careful who you trust.
Yes.
And if you have any feelings of like, maybe I shouldn't talk to that person or I need to get the hell out of Dodge with my friends, get out. Male or female.
Yeah.
Because there's no way these people are being, in my opinion, watched and or tipped off of someone that got GHB dropped in or that is way drunk. And there's no way it's not being done with some kind of intelligent network.
And you bring up one important point that you brought up earlier is that lone wolf aspect that gentlemen seem to have, that men seem to have. Even if they're on the road for work, what have you, you know, men seem to have no compunction of hopping to a local bar and being a bar fly up at a bar for 3-4 hours by themselves, having a few drinks, getting inebriated and walking back to a hotel room. Women seem to have less compunction to do so. They tend to once again go out in pairs, groups, safety, things like that. It's what they've been taught to do, and good for them. Fantastic, because it is safer. And I think this really also exposes the seedy underbelly of the fact of we oftentimes forget that men can be targeted, that we are just as unsafe, you know, like even in my industry, it's one of those that like I attend conferences where people are walking out with swag bags and name tags from a conference center. Like you're only there because your company sent you there with a business card. You know, every pickpocket in town knows that. The Austin Convention Center is one of the only ones that I know of that on the glass on the way out, it says, for your own safety, please remove your conference name badge. Mm-hmm. You know, because it is literally making you a target. You walk out in the middle of Philly, something like that, you know, and you don't really think about that. Subconsciously, you don't think about that, you know, and it's interesting to see that, this is happening right up against that district, right up against the conference area of Austin. It's not like this is an outskirts area or something like that. This is the Rainy Street area is a major suburban area. It is an area for bar hopping. stuff like that. It is one of the happening nightlife areas, and it happens mm-hmm. to be a block or so away from the edge of Lady Bird Lake.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so how does dark outdoors get involved in this? Because it's fishermen that find these people.
Yeah.
It is kayakers that find these people on waterways. And I wanted to use my network of listeners and people who are outdoors lovers on the right. water to be cognizant, because just as dangerous perhaps as being in a bar like that, what if you come across a body being dumped? What if yeah. you're seen? What if you come, or maybe you could be the one that sees something, and you can be the one that helps solve one of these crimes. So that's why I think it's through the Dark Outdoors platform, because it's found the bodies are taken from a city, put into a water environment where fishermen, kayakers, you know, all these people are.
Yeah.
And that is the outdoors element. And there was even a case of, you know, someone that was in a farming area and their body was found in a lake not too far from there in a very strange way. And so there's all these things, and water is a solvent. So it's the best solvent in the world. So it's a great way to erase
evidence. You know, it gets rid of a lot of trace evidence, most trace yes. evidence. As
so a matter of fact. It's a very disturbing trend.
Yeah.
And I think if it's ever solved in terms of, and William Ramsey, in one of my podcasts on Dark Outdoors, he said he believes there's a couple of people that have been arrested. This is not just America. It's a global thing.
Yeah.
It could be some yeah. of the perpetrators related crimes that have very similar connective tissue. But if there's ever a network of this, like a group that did this, busted, I think we're going to be shocked at where it goes. This is so dark and so evil and so insidious, and it has the earmarkings of things we've seen with other high profile crimes out there. I'm not at liberty to talk too deeply about that, but I will say that this is a highly intelligent predator type situation. This isn't just some, Bundy was a very intelligent guy, Ted Bundy.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was freaking lost at the end in terms he couldn't control it all. He was like on a slasher rampage, right?
Yeah.
This is calculated. This is planned. This is executed in such an intelligible way. Because obviously the biggest question to ask is this. It's not even like, how were they taken? It is, where were they taken?
That's right. That's right.
Where? Because these bodies that are showing up a month later that have the profile of a body that were in the water for 48 to 72 hours are not rotting in the water. They're being taken somewhere else, held, and then put in the water. To me, that's the scariest part of the whole deal.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. The fact that they are being removed from what is a pretty public situation, either by drug or coercion or a combination of the two.
Yeah, I think the drugging thing has a huge element of that.
And things like human trafficking come to mind.
Sure.
I mean, good Lord, you could jump down the adrenochrome rabbit hole if you wanted to, as to what's happening to these guys for 3-4 days between the time that they go missing and the time that they're found, sometimes a month. And it's not like the body's floating for a month, not like they got drunk, hit their head, and you know, got washed away in the tide or something, and their body's found a month later, waterlogged by 30 days. Their body's waterlogged by maybe 48 hours in most of these cases.
Well, what's going to happen is the Austin thing took off bigger than any of these other cases in terms of the media part of it, right? I mean, it just went viral really quickly.
Yeah.
Other police departments and law enforcement agencies around the country are watching this, and they are going to figure out how to avoid these stories going that direction, because the last thing they want is this in the media in this way.
Well,
so I guarantee you there's already some subversion going on with some of these kind of cases in different places.
Well, even some of the reporting of the cases, because one of the last cases that was reported here before the one you were just talking about, the one 6 months ago, it was blunt force trauma. It was blunt force trauma. It was blunt force trauma. Then suddenly, it became the fact that it was a suicide by gunshot.
Yeah.
And it's like, yo, those are two vastly different things.
Well, I'm not a forensics expert.
Yeah. Yeah. Me neither.
I could figure out gunshot wound versus blunt force trauma pretty quickly.
Yeah. You would think so.
Yes. Yeah, and so they're muddying the waters, and so all you people listening who do spend time around, not only Lady Bird Lake, but in the outdoors in general, right, especially around metro areas, just watch. Watch what you're seeing. Look, if anything's suspicious, you know, keep a safe eye on it. And, you know, you might be the one that could solve this. You might have that piece of information. And then, of course, people going out clubbing. Now I have the weird record of playing in metal bands for 18 years and having never been drunk, never smoked a joint. I'm like a unicorn, right? So when I was in some of these clubs we played or went into, I saw things from a slightly different eye, but it was all aimed at like, some dude, I had to intervene a couple of times and kind of like subvert people because I could tell there was a really drunk chick. And then I could see taking advantage of date rape kind of stuff going, you know. So several times we intervened and tried to like, you know, tell, hey bartender, hey, call somebody for this girl, whatever, because she don't know what the hell she's doing right now. And this guy over here, you know, that kind of stuff. You see that, but this is like beyond, like, those are like Neanderthal type dudes, right?
Yeah.
This is not that at all. And that's what I want people to know. I don't like the title Rainy Street Ripper. This isn't a one person show. This isn't a normal serial killer thing. This is a different, it's a new breed of killing. And, if we ever find out, it's going to be one of those stories that I think we're going to talk about 100 years from now.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Here's the thing that I think what'll end up happening is they'll, maybe not in Austin, but somewhere there will be a survivor. There'll be an escape at some point. They'll screw up.
Have there not already been a couple that they believe?
Yeah, there are. But I'm talking about one that gets to see the whole picture.
Gotcha.
One of them that's around long enough, they can see all the moving parts enough to put it together.
Yeah.
There have been some there was one that they're pursued by a vehicle like the night before that they were taken. And so there's a whole litany.
There was the guy in Boston
that was
drugged. I mean, he ended up like going to court, all kinds of stuff, because woke up inside of the tunnels, called the police, and they found him waving at them from a grating at the top of a tunnel.
And there's another one in Boston where the guy, you know, they end up finding him dead in water, talking to his fiance.
Yeah.
And they have the camera footage of him walking out. He could hold his liquor. He didn't even stay for the whole game. It was like a Celtics game. He's completely out of it. She's around the corner and he's saying, hey, I'm here. And then 2 minutes later, the brother's gone.
Yeah. And that's the one that I was saying. That was one of the ones I was saying that they found moored down.
Yeah.
That was tied to bricks and chains and stuff.
It's unbelievable. So there's a lot to this, and someone will end up escaping one of these and having the details that does it and that kind of, one of these people involved will want a claim to fame one day and out everybody else in a police deal and,
get caught.
Yeah. And then be like, hold on a second. You might caught on something else and go, hold on a second. I have a bargaining tool. I've got some information that like you give me this little reduced sentence and I'll give you the smiley face. Yeah,
I'll give you the tour address.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So that's where this is going. And it's a very concerning. I have a lot of younger men in my life. One of them who fishes Lady Bird Lake.
I have a really good friend that fishes Lady Bird Lake.
He fishes kayaks, fishes all the time. He's perfectly clean and sober. So he doesn't have to worry about that end of it. Sure. But I said, hey, pal, you fit the demographic. So keep your eyes out.
Well, you know? And you know, it was honestly here in Austin, it was the alt community that brought this to the headlines, because it was young homosexual men who were originally disappearing. And they started shooting flares in the air in their community, like, hey, guys at the club, keep your eyes out, you know.
Well, you know,
and then that hit the news.
I have multiple friends in law enforcement. I got a friend who's on a SWAT team. I've got a friend who's an investigator, and people that I love and respect. But like any branch of humanity, there are screw ups, right? There are people that are not ethical. And there was a case with Jeffrey Dahmer where he had a young boy who escaped, ran out naked, screaming to African-American. The reason I mentioned their race, because that was part of it, called the police. They show up. Dahmer says no. He comes out and says, we're having a sex game. And they send him back. And that was one of the heads they found in his freaking freezer.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now, the women said the cops didn't take their story seriously because they were African-American young girls and there were some issues in that community. So when you come into things like this, and because it's easiest to blow up, oh, that's a bunch of drunk people.
Yeah.
That's a gay guy and in a underground bar or whatever's going on. But here's what I say. These are all people, human beings, and we need to be cognizant that there is a new kind of predator targeting these people.
Yeah.
And we need to take any preconceived notions of people aside or judgment on what they're out there doing and look at that. Those are maybe a brother. There may be, they're all sons.
That's right.
You know,
that's
nephews, right. Friends of someone. And so I don't know, man. So I have a slogan for Dark Outdoors. Now, my slogan is pray, prepare, and pack heat. So
that's right.
That's it. Because I'm also coming out with a shirt. Chris, you're going to like this. Okay. I haven't developed the imagery yet, but it's going to say, I will not put the lotion on. I will not squeal like a pig or become a human sacrifice. Dark Outdoors.
I like it.
And it's going to have like a gun on it. So it's even more less. It's even less PC. And, because that's what it's all about. And I'm like, not happening. So that's what we try to prevent is, you know, there's a couple of things going on in the Dark Outdoors realm. I've got one that's mind blowing, Chris. I mean, if you got a minute,
please, please.
I've got one that's like my current favorite.
Go ahead.
So my good friend and your friend, Lyle Blackburn, was at a conference with me, Texas Bigfoot Conference. No, it was the Fountain Monster Festival this year, actually. Uh-huh. And, he said, hey, do you remember you were friends of Rob Riggs, right? And Rob was a writer. He was a newspaper writer for years. He wrote a book called Alma Trail of the Wild Man about Bigfoot and the phenomenon of the Big Thicket region. And I said, yeah. He goes, you remember Rob mentioning like he thought that like someone said they saw like a Karankawa Indian in the Big Thicket. And I'm like, I do kind of remember that. And so he goes, he'd heard something somebody said about hearing something that sounded more tribal than like, a very strange thing. So I went back in my archives and got my book, and Rob had a whole section of the book about these different sightings where people, hunters, and one of them was a lineman putting a line in this area, reported seeing primitive looking Indians and two different occasions where people were shot at. This was in the Old and Lost River, Trinity River Basin along the I-10 corridor in the Trinity Bay.
Wow.
And also in the Big Thicket National Preserve. And I thought it was intriguing because there were two tribal groups that sort of like it could have been either one. And both of them had links to cannibalism in their history.
Yep.
And they were known to be very big, like Karankawas were big. And so the one that made me believe the report, because Rob was a very good newspaper writer, and he told one of the stories in a Lamar class. He was a professor there. And one of his students goes, oh, my mom has a story all about that, and told another story. And there's a collection of these up until at least the 1980s. in this Alden Lost River, Trinity Bay area on the northern tier of the Galveston Bay complex into the Trinity and Old Lost River area. And then also in the Big Thicket, which is about 30 miles, 35 miles to the north, same basic basin. And so Lyle and I are doing some research on it, and I decided to go ahead and do a Dark Outdoors podcast just talking about the reports that, you know, that my good friend, the dearly departed Rob Riggs mentioned. And when I did, I got a message from a guy whose father was a sheriff in the area when that was going on. And he had an entirely different report, same area, Old Lost River. And there was a, three hunters coming out of, the, of that area at night, and they had headlamps on, and they noticed ahead of them, they could see people, six men, look, they thought were naked, but they did have like loincloth on, carrying something. And when they got close enough, they said it looked like primitive Indians, and one of them shot an arrow at them. They disappeared into the brush and they raised their rifles. This guy saw, when he was a young man in the 70s, the Polaroid of the arrow that had been kept.
What?
Yes. So I did a whole show on Dark Outdoors. You can see it's in one of my last episodes I did for the season on Dark Outdoors on this topic. And I'm asking other people, have you ever encountered anything like that? And I got to thinking, let's just say the last, say there was a hidden tribe. The last one was in the 80s. Say 89 was the cutoff, right? That's 35 years ago, right? Almost 36 years ago.
Yeah.
A lot less developed than all that back then. I also got to thinking, could there have been people, you know, back in the 60s, everybody was getting back to nature, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Could there have been people who decided to go off grid and live as their ancestors?
Sure.
And live like this. The one of the Big Thickets interesting is they saw him in a dugout. These guys were in a canoe, and they come around. There's a dude in a dugout, and it's totally like a primitive native tribal member. And now Lyle has been doing his own research for a reason, and I've been doing my own research for Dark Outdoors. And he turned me onto a book, and I got to reading this book, and it mentioned that, you know, the Karankawa people just, by the way, they just disappeared.
Yeah.
No one's really sure what happened. And the other tribe, the, I must say the name wrong, the Attakapins were, which I found out yesterday was, the Choctaw name for cannibal. All right. Mm. They live where I live. There's actually a historical marker about 3 miles from where I'm sitting right now, talking about the cannibal tribe that lived here. Right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But, it says on the Karankawas that they were known to move a lot and be kind of transient. Right. And that they would often travel in groups of six men. So there were six men and two of the, one of the report that I got and one of the reports in Rob Riggs' book, wow. Six were both mentioned. Wow. So a lot of interesting stuff going on. So I'm really digging into, could there have been lost tribal in small, small numbers living in some of these forests off grid? Could there still be?
Yeah.
And also, could it have been people that just simply wanted to go back and live as their ancestors did? Or was it survivors? It is a wild, intriguing thing. And I'm going to throw something out there that really struck me. There's stuff in Bigfoot research that like these really ornate like limb formations and things like this that almost has more of a human intelligence realm to it.
Yep.
Is it possible some of that stuff could be like these, some of these lost tribe people?
Yeah.
Is that possible? And another thing I find interesting about the Karankawa in particular, it talked about they were unbelievably tough at surviving nature's conditions, like freezes. And they were just, you know, like just unbelievably tough people. Yeah. So interesting stuff. It is my current, true fascination into this. And kind of a cutting edge deal. Wild, the episode's fun, but I'm planning on doing a lot more on it. I know Lyle's working on his own
thing.
That
is cool. I definitely want to hear more about that one. And, you know, it was funny because just at Thanksgiving, my dad called me. And he was like, I have a story for you. And my dad's not really, well, he's one that like kind of whenever we go out to Falk and stuff like that, like that used to be part of his sales route. And he was like, man, what are y'all doing going out there looking for Bigfoot? Like, what are you like, that's just not his thing. You
yeah,
know?
I got you.
And he called me up and he's like, I have this story for you. And he started telling me this was a guy that apparently my mother-in-law, or I guess stepmom, knows, who was out hunting in East Texas.
Okay.
And in a blind on his buddy's property, out there on a hunt for the weekend. And while he was in, just before dawn, while he was in the blind, started hearing something mess around with the door on the blind.
Huh.
And he was like, when I got in there, you know, there was all kinds of trash, stuff like that. I emptied it out and got in and proceeded to sit down to hunt. And this thing started messing around with the door. And, you know, figured maybe it was a passing migrant or something like that, you know, passing through the woods, homeless person, whatnot. He was like, so, you know, hey, man, I'm in here hunting, you know, like you better watch out. He was like, things went on for a little while, nothing. About 30 minutes later or so, he heard it again. And he was like, hey, like, I've got a gun. I'm in here. Like, don't make me call anybody. I'm in here hunting right now, you know? Little while later, he's sitting there and a hand reaches through the front of the blind and grabs him by the throat. He ends up pulling his sidearm, shooting it. It's an orangutan.
What?
It's an orangutan.
That goes right into my feral ape stuff.
Exactly. I was like, I have a guy that I am interviewing in a week.
I got to talk to this guy.
I was just about to say, let me see if I could get you in touch with this guy. Because apparently there was a pair of them. There was a pair of them that got out off of a property down the road. Is what ended up happening. But this guy ended up shooting an orangutan that attacked him in a deer blind.
Dude, it doesn't get more dark outdoors
and
wild than that.
Exactly.
You know, and I have a new YouTube channel called Global Bigfoot. And I'm doing some really cool Bigfoot stuff. And we're focusing a lot of our efforts on using as a platform to find kids we can work with. A lot of kids are into Bigfoot. And kids in our, you know, that are facing special challenges that we work with, and working on a mini doc on feral primates in the Bigfoot thing right now. And wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, please go subscribe to that. That'll help me out a lot. And, wow, I have to talk to this guy.
I will see what I can do to get in touch with him and see what I can do to build that bridge for you, man. Cause when I heard it, I was like, oh my God. Like, we talk about that kind of stuff all the time, or we're just sitting around at dinner.
Yeah,
things like that.
Orangutan, man. That's crazy.
Yeah, straight up got choked by an orangutan in a deer blind.
Hey, bro, they got some strength. I've got to interact with an orangutan before for a little while, and I'm glad he was on my side. Because they could jack you up.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, it's interesting because once again, the idea of dark outdoors, the idea of educating people to the other side of the outdoors, Chester, we have a very romanticized idea of outdoor living and things like that, you know, returning to the wild, going out and fishing and things like that. Like you go out regularly with your fly rod and just, hey, there's a body of water. Let me hop out and get after it. You know,
I do it all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
and I used to do the same thing with a pole. You know, I just had one in my trunk. But I don't know if I would do it so much around places like Lady Bird Lake anymore.
Well, you know, that's a great point, Chris. You mentioned that like you might have had a change in your, you know, looking at some of this. Well,
man, I used to night fish at Addicts Dam, man.
When you're the dark outdoors guy, you definitely look at it a little differently.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you two crazy examples that have happened to me since the dark outdoors journey has begun, right? And both of them happen in Florida, okay? So we have our program, Wild Wishes, where we grant wildlife encounters with a critical illness. traumatic loss. We even work with trafficking victims. And we actually have one member who's in our family, Lisa's cousin, stepson. His brother was murdered in the streets. And so we know him well. I normally don't take off with a kid in the program by myself, but this kid's family. So the family dropped me and him off at this canal in Florida. I fished a peacock bass fish, right?
Yeah.
And he caught his first peacock bass in 10 minutes of being there, which was amazing, right?
Cool.
Just amazing. Dream come true for him. And we're sitting there fishing, and I look across. It's by this landfill in the middle of nowhere in Homestead, Florida. And I look, and brother, there are two gigantic pit bulls about 100 yards away. And when I turn around and look, they are dead focused and they're growling and they run straight to us like a bolt of lightning. I turn around, I said, Jerry, there are two big dogs coming right at us, bro. So I want you not to move. And I just started praying and reciting the 23rd Psalm and invoking the name of Christ. Because I had no weapon. I'm in another state. I can't carry it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, we're against the guardrail. We're on the ditch side of a guardrail of a ditch, right? All of a sudden, I felt something touching my leg. And it's one pit bull going under. And we're talking feral dog. These are not someone's pets. And the other on the other side of Jerry, they didn't even recognize we were there. They just went in the water, got a drink of water, ran, and they were on. They were growling and snarling as they're charging.
Wow.
So that was one. But here's the really creep. By the way, my feral dog episode is the number one most downloaded Dark Outdoors episode.
Oh, I'll bet.
And I've had so many people out there. And somebody said, well, Chester, you mentioned a pit bull. Hey, I'm just mentioning the breed. It could have been any dog. But I'll give you this. I'd rather I had a Yorkie chasing me. You know what I mean? They're like, yeah, two Yorkies, yeah, are coming. Sweet,
yeah, bring,
you
know? Bring on the corgis.
Yeah, give me the corgi, not a pit or a mastiff or something huge, right? Anyway, the other one was another trip to Florida, same general area. And we found a canal that was like awesome. And so we pulled over on one side of the road, walking over to the canal, and I go back, me and my buddy Mike Williams, and there's a little, it looks like a deer trail going in the woods. There are deer there, no big deal. All of a sudden, this old vehicle comes driving out of the woods, like straight out of the woods. And as the brush is parting with their vehicle, I can see it opens up into this weird trail and an old creepy looking barn back in the woods. And I'm like, Mike's like, I got to stop fishing with the Dark Outdoors guy. So it happens. And we're trying to make people. What I tell people is the outdoors is a place of solitude and beauty and just great recreation. But sometimes the outdoors experience goes dark.
Well,
and we're trying to let people come home to their families and have some fun telling some crazy stories along the way.
But you know, be safe while you're out there, while you're doing things. Once again, like, I used to go out night fishing by myself. Yep. I don't know that I would do that anymore. I definitely have a buddy
just
with
had
me.
My wife and I just had this exact conversation a week ago. I would go night fishing by myself at an area down close to my home. Mm. And we saw some guys night fishing another spot. I'm like, that's a pretty good spot. They got it locked in. They know what they're doing. Because me and my dad fished when I was a kid. And I'm like, you know what? I just don't night fish for myself anymore.
Yeah.
Because of the people that are running around out there, and you just got to be careful and not expose yourself to danger. Don't be afraid. Be aware. Go in and have a great time. Go in with a plan. If you're out there in a dark trail somewhere parked, the direction you got to retreat, that way you don't have to back up. I learned that from slasher movies, you get the point, the direction you got to go. If you can carry, right? Have a game plan. Let someone know where you're going to be and what time you'll be home.
Yeah.
All right. If you can carry a transponder, have a spot X, you can get trouble, hit one button and every emergency thing will get your, your location by a text.
Yep.
And so there's a lot of things you can do.
There are even apps that you can install on your phone that emergency ping your last location if your battery dies, things like that, you know?
Yeah, we gotta get into all that stuff. And maybe I can get you on. We'll do a tech dark outdoors.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
The tech side of stuff. So, yeah. But it's always a great being on your show, man.
Thank you. And
it's a lot of fun. And I appreciate what you do by letting people have a voice.
Well, I greatly appreciate it. But in my mind, that's what it's about. That's how we build communities. And that's how communities help keep each other safe and help keep each other out there doing things. Because, you know, it's like we've said before in episodes, like we pointed out, not just with you, but with Lyle Blackburn, with King Gerhardt, others. It's the idea of, if you believe in cryptids, if you're into this kind of stuff, you better get on board with Chester and get into wildlife conservation and get into conserving their habitat.
That's what you need to do.
So it's one of the most important things that we can do is know our outdoors, be prepared for our outdoors, and when we're out there, to be prepared and be safe and be forward thinking about it. So
absolutely.
I'm all about everything that you're doing. And I love the fact that you are going to be going even more full bore this year with Dark Outdoors. It's fantastic.
I can't say too much. Remember, I can share things with Brother Chris. I can't share with the public because I trust and love this man.
That's right.
But I will say this. He's right. Full bore is coming, baby.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So you have a great holiday season, my friend. Thank you so much for the time. Let everybody know one last time where they can go to keep up with Dark Outdoors, where they can go to follow that award-winning podcast, where they can go to keep up with Higher Calling Wildlife, and where they can go to help out with helping a kid's wish come true in the wild, all that kind of stuff. Chester, before we let you go.
Thank you. That's so important. So the most important thing that I do is this ministry work to help kids. And so you can help us there, bring the love of Christ to hurting kids through wildlife encounters. You can go to higher calling.net and click on the youth outreach link. And there's ways to donate right there. And also, you can go to kingdomzoo.com for donations. And if you want to keep up with the Dark Outdoors podcast, any podcasting platform, go right now, subscribe on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, you name it, we're there. And Global Bigfoot, my new YouTube channel. Check that out. And a lot of fun stuff going on. And always check out the Curious Realm here. Christopher has a lot of awesome guests and people on here. And I appreciate his friendship. He's a great dude, and it's an honor to be on the show.
Hey, man, thank you so much. I appreciate the kind words. It's always great chatting with you on and off air. I will do what I can to find the orangutan man for you.
Please. You made my whole day. That's my Christmas present.
I thought I would.
My Christmas present is going to be I get to talk to someone attacked by a flipping orangutan in East Texas.
I know, right? So stay tuned for that one. Well, but take care of yourself, bud. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. Yep. While you are online, everybody, at higher calling.net, following everything from Chester Moore, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find on curiousrealm.com/videos all of the YouTube channels of our guests. We will absolutely go and add the Global Bigfoot page there so that you can easily find it right there with all of our guest channels that we have embedded. That is also where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are out doing field work in the world of paranormal research, cryptid research, UFO, UAP research, make sure to stop on by and get your copy of that. This is your chance to be able to write your data down in the field in a scientific way as it happens, so you can prepare your data to shake hands with science. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time this week. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.